All right, there we go. Good morning. Welcome in this room. Welcome if you're in the communion room out in the chapel. Welcome online, however it is that you're here. We're really glad. So take your Bibles, and we're going to go to Genesis, and we'll go to chapter 40 today. Chapter 40. If you need a Bible, just wave at the ushers. They'll be glad to spot you one, or you can certainly use your technology. As you're turning, I'll ask you a question. Have you ever had a friend who was feeling discouraged? Just sort of in a down season, sort of a discouragement. I think it's probably one of the most prevalent emotions that we deal with in life and subsequently in ministry, because life is just full of those kicks in the gut that take away, cancel, remove, break people's courage. And that's what the prefix dis means, to subtract. I remember when I was a young guy, just graduated from college, one of my fraternity brothers, he had just married a cute gal, and they just loved each other, and they loved the Lord, and 4 years later, he was burying her. She had died of breast cancer, just like that, and he was just so, understandably, just so down, so discouraged. I can think of any number of people who've married the love of their life and said, till death will we part, do we part, and yet about 50% of them have parted along the way, and there's heartbreak and heartache and sadness and discouragement. Another couple who desperately wants kids, but they can't have kids for whatever reason. Another, even this morning, talked to somebody who's morning that they eliminated my job, and I'm scared. I'm feeling like, what do I have to offer? There's just this lack of courage, discouragement. Some who would say, you know, why does my child have to be the one who struggles with this challenge so much? Another who says, how could my friend betray me like she just did, or like he just did? I guess you could look upon discouragement as one of those emotions that's sort of like a condo. And you have three relationships with that condo. Either you're living in it right now, or you just got out, or there's a reservation with your name and a date on it. You just don't know when it is. It's just one of these things that comes with life, and we don't get a pass on it. You see that throughout Scripture. From the Old Testament all the way through, there are the hard times, and Jesus said there's going to be trials and tribulations. These just come to our lives, and we're certainly seeing this in the life of Joseph. He's the one that we're focused on this final third in our journey through the book of Genesis. Let's just remind ourselves where we've been. Joseph, who had grown up the favorite child of Jacob, out of all his 12, all the 12 brothers, he was the favored one, and it wasn't subtle. You remember he got that robe of many colors, and he would have these dreams, and he would tell all the brothers, look at this dream. You're all going to bow down to me one day. He was a mix of proud and naive. He didn't know better, and he was spoiled, and his father hadn't made him go to bed when he made the other boys, and he hadn't made him go out in the field when he made the other boys. And so he was just soft. And the brothers, they got envious. And they just couldn't stand anymore. And so finally they wrap him up and sell him off to slave traders who were passing through and headed to Egypt. And he was 17. And we tend to forget the amount of time that's passing. I mean, we're going to cover his life in 6 or 7 or 8 weeks. But this is years. And so what we've covered and what we're going to cover today is really about a decade. I want you to have this in mind, okay? I want you to think back 10 years ago. Like, go back in your mind. How old were you? What was going on? That's how much time is passing. By the time we get to him today, he's around 27. So he's been sold off to this man called Potiphar, who's an authority in the Egyptian government. And so he puts his hand to the plow and starts working. Joseph does, and he's found to be a good laborer, and Potiphar trusts him with more and more and more. And finally, he's running all of Potiphar's household. And the favor of God rested upon Joseph. And you think that's good, but the problem was Potiphar wasn't the only one who'd noticed him. Potiphar's wife had noticed him too. And she thought, well, he's all right. And so I'm sure it started out sort of subtle, but then over time, she's just, her overtures are as subtle as a freight train at night. And now he's having to slither out of his tunic and run off bare-chested without a shirt just to preserve his integrity. She's coming on to him so strong. And then, because of the person that she was or wasn't, she cries rape. And now he gets put in prison for something he's never done. And so you have a passing of 10 years, forsaken by his brother, sold off as a slave, proven as a worthy slave, and with the favor of God on him, though nobody down there really knows who God is, but he does. And now he's in prison for something he hasn't done, and he's about 27 years old. And you have to imagine at this point, he's like, God, what is going on? I mean, how can every single thing in my life go so bad? I remember when I was young, I used to have dreams, and I thought there was going to be, I don't know. This is where we'll pick it up. I said 40, but we'll go back to 39 just to catch a couple of the verses that Steve hit last week. But that'll give us a good running start. Starting in 20b. While Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. And he showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those he held in prison and was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden ended up paying no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him a success and whatever. So now he's led Potiphar's house. Now he leads the prison. He just leads anything he does. Verse 41. Sometime later, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the same prison where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard assigned him to Joseph. And so Joseph attended them. And after they'd been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker, were held in the prison. They each had a dream the same night. And each dream had a meaning of its own. Verse 6, when Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. So he asked Pharaoh's officials, why do you look so sad today? They answered, we both had dreams, but there's no one to interpret them. Joseph said, don't interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams. So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream and said to him, in my dream, I saw a vine in front of me. And on the vine were three branches. And soon it budded, blossomed, clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand. And I took the grapes and I squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup and I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Joseph said, this is what it means. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. And you will put the cup of Pharaoh back in his hand, just as you used to. When all goes well, remember me and show me kindness and mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews. And even here, I've done nothing to be deserving of being put in the dungeon. So when the chief baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, well, I had a dream too. On my head were three baskets of bread. In the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. And Joseph said, well, this is what your dream means. The three baskets are 3 days, and within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and impale your body on a pole, and the birds will eat away your flesh. The baker said, that's the last time I'm ever asking you. No, that's not really what he said. Sure enough, now the third day was Pharaoh's birthday, and he prepared a banquet for all his officials and staff, and he summoned his chief cupbearer and chief baker to join the other officials, and he restored the chief cupbearer to his position so that once again he put the cup in Pharaoh's hand, and he impaled the chief baker, just as Joseph has said to them in his interpretation. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. And he'd be there two more years. Now, what I want to do in our time is I want to lift out three observations I believe that we can learn from this text, and we'll do well to learn when it comes to the dungeons of our own lives. Because here and there, we're all going to end up in a dungeon. There's just going to be seasons of discouragement. They're unavoidable. And so the first one is this: God wastes no season. God wastes no season. And we're going to see that God has been working in this season of Joseph's life. You remember, he'd gone when he was 17. And for 10 years now, he's been forsaken, he's been rejected, he's been a slave, he's been falsely accused. But God had been working. He hadn't been wasting the season. He's not going to waste the season while he's in prison. You remember, as I said a little while ago, the story had started off, he was a mix of naive and proud, untested, soft, blathered on too much, unable to read the cues in other people's faces, like, that's enough with the dreams. But you notice what happens when you get over there to the next verse, 6. When the men came to them that morning, he saw, they were dejected. And so he asks them, why do you look so sad today? Now, what is this called? It's called empathy. He didn't have any of that when he was 17. God's clearly been teaching him something. He's clearly been growing. He's reading facial cues now. He's like, oh, I think I see some. This doesn't look quite right. And so we're seeing here, God is wasting no season. Didn't waste a season in Joseph's life. And he won't waste a season in your life, even if it's a discouraging season. He works in those. Wish somebody had explained that to me back when I was a young guy. I was in seminary working on my master's degree to become a pastor. I was 24. And one of the courses that you had to take was called a CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. And you had to work in a hospital. And so I decided, well, I'll move home to Houston and live with my parents. And I got hired at MD Anderson. I've told you about it before. I don't know if I've told this part of the story very recently, though. And so I was hired to work at MD Anderson, which ended up being one of the hardest summers of my life. And the reason it's hard is not because I didn't meet so many wonderful people. It's just that all day long, I was going into people's rooms and talking with them. And you have to understand, and some of you know, MD Anderson's an amazing place. And miracles come out of MD Anderson. God is working miracles through MD Anderson. But it is an experimental hospital. And all the trials don't work. And so the job of the chaplain is that you console them grieving. And it's very draining. It's very hard. I remember I'd go from room to room, and sometimes I'm going in after the doctor's just told a mom or a dad, your child's not going to live much longer. And I would go in, and I'd be praying with them and holding them and looking at the poor child. And I'd hold it together until I could get down the hall, and I'd go in the bathroom, and I'd go in the stall, and I would just sob like a baby. I'd never been thickened up. I didn't have any thick skin. I'd never felt pain and sadness. And even though I didn't know the people very well, you got to know them a little bit, because MD Anderson, you go for a while. It's not in and out. You know, people go, so you build these relationships. And it was particularly tired, and it was particularly exhausting and draining, but the worst of it was this man who was our supervisor, who was giving me the credit, finally, for my seminary degree that I had to earn those 3 credits. His name is Alan. Alan was ornery, irritable, nasty, rude, no fun to work for whatsoever. And he had this gray mustache, and he'd just sit there and he'd twist it around. And he's foul-mouthed, and I never was convinced he really ever knew who Jesus was, and definitely didn't love him, and which made me wonder, why did you get into ministry? Why are you a chaplain? And so he's supervising the 6 of us, and he loved the other 5. He didn't like me, and he always let me know. And he just had particular enjoyment, I could tell. He just picking on me all the time. And I'd go down the chaplaincy after I'd wipe my eyes off and come out of the bathroom, but he could tell. And I'd go sit in my little cubicle until the little buzzer went off and I had to go back to some other room. And he'd watch me come in. He'd say, "Why are you doing this to yourself?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're not meant to be a minister. You're not cut out for this. Look at you. This is killing you. You missed your calling." And I'd sit over there and I'd say, "Why am I going to work for this guy?" After about a month, he's just always saying that sort of stuff. "You're not made for this. You missed your calling." So finally I said, "Alan, what do you think I should do?" He said, "That's easy. You're a lawyer. You're a lawyer waiting to happen. Isn't that what you told me your dad is? Didn't you even tell me one time your granddad was a... You got law all in your family. And look at you. You got your big smile and you're outgoing." Back then I had a good coif of hair. He said, "You're a politician waiting to happen. In fact," he said, "I'm going to call you senator." I said, "Senator?" He said, "Yeah. You'll be a great senator. You're not meant to be here. You're a senator." And every doggone day for the rest of he called me senator. "Morning, senator. Afternoon, senator. Have a good evening, senator." He'd call me senator all summer long. This begins to work on you. He's telling me, "You're not fit to be here. You're not meant. You missed your calling. You shouldn't be doing it. Why are you putting yourself through this?" And it was hard. But thankfully, the last week of the summer, a whole year prior, I'd signed up and told this conglomeration of churches down in the Clear Lake area that I'd come and do their youth week this summer. And so the last week of the summer gets there, and I didn't want to do it. All I wanted to say is, "Life is terrible, and eventually you die, and good luck." And, you know, which isn't a great youth talk. But I pulled out something I'd used in the past, and I read it several times until I sort of believed it again. And I drove down to Clear Lake. There's 400 or 500 kids there, and they're singing all their songs. And then it's my turn, and I get up, and I start to do this talk. And I was about 5 or 10 minutes in, and I saw a couple of the kids looking forward, leaning forward. A couple more got their little books out and they started writing something. I was like, "Are you writing something I'm saying down? I'm not saying anything that great." But as I went, I realized they are listening to me. This is working. And I felt kind of inspired. And the next night I went back and I had a little bit more energy for it. And I preached a second time. And then the third night I kind of felt back to myself. And I was telling them about Jesus and how Jesus came and he died on a cross for you. And then he conquered the grave. And I want you to understand that. And I want you to know Jesus. And I want you to follow him with your whole lives. And if you would do that, I just want you to stand up right now. Would you do that? Like 100 kids stood up. So many, I thought, I don't think I made that very clear. Let me back it up again. And if you really want, and they stood up again. And And I'm telling you, afterwards, the people came, they were hugging me, and they were like, that's the best youth week we ever had. This was amazing, and God is working. And I got in my car, and I just felt like I was a new person. And so I went back into MD Anderson for the final week, and I had my one-on-one that I knew was my final one-on-one. But this time, I didn't walk into Alan's office just sort of sheepishly waiting for him to bludgeon me some more. I went marching in, plopped my binder down on the desk, and I said, Alan, I got to tell you something. He said, okay, what is it, Senator? I said, Alan, I got to tell you, I am not a senator. I'll never be a senator. God has called me to be a minister, and I know that I know that I know because I went down and I just preached about Jesus. And I don't know if you even really know who that is, but anyhow, I preached about him, and all these kids trusted him, and I know the Holy Spirit was working, and I know that's what I'm supposed to be, and so you don't ever have to worry about me being a senator again. I'm called to ministry. And yeah, and he leans back in his chair and kind of does this. And then he chuckles. He goes, well, I'm glad you finally figured it out, Reverend. Now, I didn't enjoy that summer in the least. But I'm telling you, that summer would become important in my life, especially in hard times, because ministry is hard, but life is hard. You don't need to feel sorry for me. I mean, life is hard. But in ministry, you journey with people in their lives and in the hard times, and you bury people, and you see hard things. And I've gone back to that story many times. I'm telling you, especially in 2020. I told you before that was a really rough season. You couldn't catch a break no matter what you did. And a couple of times I thought, maybe some of my friends just threw it in. I said, well, maybe I'll just punch out. Until the Lord said, no, that's not it. And the reason is he'd always take me back to that moment. See, God, he wastes no season. And if you're in a rough season, he won't waste it. I don't know how long it will last, but I know that he won't waste it. Second thing, God can use even your painful seasons. God will use even and especially your painful seasons. He leverages these for your good and for his glory. And you know this, intuitively, you know that this is true. This is why people go to divorce recovery groups or to any kind of recovery groups or to grief support groups. Why do people go to them? Why do you go to those? Because something inside you says, I need to get to someone who has been down this path that I am on, and they're still here, and they're still making it, especially if they have Jesus and their light is still shining. I gotta get to them because I just know that somehow, kind of like the lady who was bleeding and just reached out to touch Jesus, that there's something that'll come into me if I can just get by the person who is a little bit ahead of me. God will use you in those seasons. And some of you, you lead those kind of groups. And you are being used by God through the pain that now is helping other people. I saw this in my own mother-in-law, Grammy. We called her Wanda. She died a couple of years ago of cancer. But I remember one morning, about 6 months before she died, she called me. Hi, Grammy. Ken, I remember a few Sundays ago, you passed out, you had this little sheet of these Bible verses, and I think it was about anxiety or something. And do you have any more? I think there's a few sitting on my desk at church. I'll bring some over this afternoon. She said, oh, thank you, Ken. I said, how come? She said, well, the reason is because I've been trying to share the gospel with this nurse who comes over and checks on me. And I just think that verse of that sheet of the verses would be really, really helpful for her. And the thing about Grammy, she was still trying. She was letting her light shine even up to about the week or two before she died, when she just couldn't hardly even say any more words, because she wanted her hospice nurses to know the gospel. And she was letting God use her right through the final season. That's how it was for Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You remember, Bonhoeffer was a theologian from Germany. He lived back in the time of World War II. And he moved over to America to learn, to teach, and just for the American experience that would make his life all the more rich and meaningful. One of the things that's interesting about Bonhoeffer, while he was in America, he lived in New York City and he taught there. But he discovered the black church in Harlem. And he said, this is, I have got to keep going. I am fascinated. Now you have to remember, this is 100 years ago nearly. And people of color did not have any of the progress that was rightfully due that would eventually come and still comes, but not back then. And yet, despite what they were going through, he would go to the black church. I forget the name of it, but it was in Harlem. He'd go every Sunday, and he would be riveted, fascinated, inspired, because he'd watch them as they're just praising and as they're worshiping. And he says, "But and I know what you're going through." And yet there was this praise and love for the Lord that was sustaining him. Well, one thing and another, he knew, I've got to go back to Germany, because he saw what was happening with Hitler. And he said, I see where this is going. He would move back to Germany, even though his friends said, don't do it. Stay here. You're too good of a mind. You may well get killed. He would become part of a group that was plotting to kill Hitler. Even though he was a pacifist, he said, but someone has to shove a stake in the wheel spokes to slow down what is happening. But the plot wouldn't work. He'd be discovered, and he would end up going to prison for his final 18 months. But they say, those who were with him and have written about him say, the thing about Bonhoeffer is that if you were anywhere near him, you could hear his laugh, and he always still enjoyed a good joke, and he had joy, and the light never went out for him. He continued to read, and he continued to write, and he would send letters out, and all sorts of things that God just continued to use him even there. And some years ago, Suzanne and I went, and we saw a play on his life. And there was this scene, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or literal, but I think it would be certainly dripping with the truth of what we do know about Bonhoeffer. In any event, this guard, prison guard, comes into his cell in this scene. It's just the guard and Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer's reading and he's writing, and the guard comes in and he kneels down and he has this scrub brush and he just starts doing this on the floor as he's looking at Bonhoeffer. And he's moving his arm about this slowly, to the point that the audience starts laughing because it looks so odd and conspicuous. And finally, Bonhoeffer's character, he looks over and he says, well, how long do you think it's going to take you to scrub this floor at that pace? And the guard says, I hope it takes all day. He said, Mr. Bonhoeffer, what you don't know is we argue downstairs over who will get to go into your room the next day, because everybody knows that your cell is the only cell where there's any light in this whole prison. Isn't that a powerful thought, that somebody who was imprisoned and would go to the death after the Gestapo arrested and put him in there, for nothing he ever did, nothing he ever did wrong, that people wanted to be with him. Why? Because God will use you even and especially in your most challenging seasons. And he was using Bonhoeffer. And he would use Joseph as well. Now, don't you know that Joseph, he was surely hoping that when the Pharaoh's birthday came and the two men got to go up, he said, tough luck for you, baker. But don't you know that he was hoping that the cupbearer would really remember? In fact, I imagine if you go back to verses 14 and 15, where he says, but when you get there, please remember me and tell the Pharaoh about me, because it's really, I never, you know, I shouldn't be here in the first place. And don't you know that there's even more that went on in that conversation? I kind of envision Joseph grabbing the cupbearer's hand and saying, here, it's J-O-S-E-P-H. Don't forget it, okay? And I'm sure the first night that he went to bed after the cupbearer's gone upstairs and been restored, I'm sure Joseph went to bed thinking, this will probably be the last night that I go to sleep in the dungeon. Things are going to get better now. And then there was a second night. It's like, well, you know, this is probably the last night. By the third night, he was thinking, you know, I'm sure it's just some red tape. Probably some bureaucracy, getting tied up. But night after night, he realized, I'm not coming out. I'm here to stay. He would stay there two more years. Why? Because the cupbearer, it says, had forgotten him. And we feel that way sometimes ourselves. I think I'm totally forgotten. And this, in fact, tends to be one of the arguments that I hear people say for the reasons I don't believe in God. Really, how come? Well, I could never follow a God who allows such pain and suffering and all the things, the bad things in life. To which I typically think to myself, well, that's convenient, but it's incomplete. It's incomplete because the reality is pain and suffering is everyone's lot in life. It doesn't matter your world religion. Every single world religion tries to give some explanation and some application for here's how you'll get through it and you'll reach nirvana if you do. Everybody has an approach. But don't you see what sets Christianity apart from all the rest is that in Christianity, we have the one true God who didn't exempt himself from the pain, from the suffering, but rather who said, no, I'll play by the same rules. And so taking the very form of a man, he put on flesh and blood and he came as Jesus, living the life of sinlessness that we couldn't live, dying the death of punishment that we deserve, so that he could eventually conquer the grave we would never conquer. He says, I'll enter into the full experience and I'll go through it with you. And so what I try and help people understand is that we actually follow a God who knows what it feels like to be beaten up and thrown in a dungeon, spat upon, even to die, because he went through that himself. He didn't exempt himself. He knows because he walks on wounded feet. And so even though the cross doesn't tell us the answer as to why we have to go through the things that we have to go through, certainly not in the season that we're in, the cross does tell us what the answer cannot be. It cannot be that he doesn't love us. It cannot be that he doesn't care, because he chose to plunge, as it were, into the dungeon of human depravity. He goes through it, which leads to the final thing. No one gets a pass. No one gets a pass, not even the Lord himself. Everybody has to go through it. So I want to close with a little thought exercise I was pondering. Suppose that it were possible to have a time machine, and you get in the time machine, and suppose you dialed up back at the foot of the cross. So you go through time, and then there you are, standing with the disciples that didn't run off, and the ladies, and the mother of Jesus crying, and there's Jesus dying on the cross, and you're standing right there. But you look like them, and you sort of blend in, and yet you know what you know. Wouldn't you not be a little tempted to want to say, "Yeah, trust me, people. This story gets so much better in about 3 days. If you could just hang on." But if you were to say that, they would look at you like you're out of your mind. What are you talking about? He's dead. The one we followed, the one we've given our life to, he's gone. The miracles are over. We don't have any hope. Again, you couldn't be faulted for wanting to say, "You're really not so. If you could just trust, actually this story takes a way better turn." This is all part of what we'll later call the great plan of salvation. Now, let's apply it forward. Suppose you are going through a season right now yourself. And suppose that someone who knows and loves you from 20 or 30 years out were able to come back to us right now in 2024. You feel like it's hopeless. There's no hope. But what if they came back and were to say, "Actually, this story does get better"? It might be 3 days, might be 3 years. We don't know, but it's gonna get better. Why can we say that with certainty? Because we know that God works all things to the good, together for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. You say, "But you don't know my diagnosis. I mean, I think this may be it. I may die." And you may, and all of us will. And so we know that day comes sooner or later for all of us. But even Paul knew that. And what did he say? He said, "For me to live is Christ, to die is gain." Because what do I gain? I get in heaven. I get to be with him. So if I live, I'll let Christ shine through me. But if this is it for me, I get to be with him. You don't lose. So brothers and sisters, I don't know what you're going through, but I do know that I know that I know that what I've preached to you today is true. I know it from my own life. I know it from watching hundreds and probably thousands at this point of other lives. Even more important, I know it because of God's word. And so my hope is that no matter how bad it seems today, you'll press on. Don't give up. Stay with him and let him carry you through. Amen. Let's pray together.